From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Fear. It can stop us, overwhelm us, even motivate us, like the people we meet pushing for justice despite a scary reality.
I'm here to fight for somebody who was educated and was doing something good for the community. And at the end of the day, they still got shot because of the color of their skin.
And we hear about the unexpected popularity of the Mexican folk saint of death.
Santísima Muerte loves people who are sort of out of the norm. She became very popular because she spread very rapidly through what people would call the fringe of society.
Plus, people speaking up for themselves at border checkpoints, and our founder, Maria Martin, on lessons learned by having to face cancer head on. All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we talk about the things we fear. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today we're talking about fear. Now, here's something that sends a chill down the spine of many.
How you doing, sir?
Hey, good. How you doing?
Not too bad. U.S. Border Patrol checkpoint.
Mm-hmm.
What country is this of?
For years, people passing through Border Patrol checkpoints have answered agents' questions without complaining. Lately, though, some are refusing to answer. Instead, they talk about their rights, quoting everything from American Civil Liberties Union pamphlets to the Constitution. Some even record their checkpoint encounters and post them on YouTube. Debbie Nathan has more.
What's up, man?
How you doing today, sir?
Good.
You a U.S. citizen?
That's my business.
Most of these YouTube videos have been put up since 2010. It's easy to find them. Just type the phrase, Border Patrol Checkpoint Refusal.
I'm not answering your question.
Citizen or not.
I have a Fifth Amendment right not to answer that.
Okay.
The Constitution supersedes
Ma'am,
your whatever it is.
If you're a U.S. citizen or not.
I need you to answer my question.
Sir.
Hey, guy, all you have to do is answer.
Can I ask you a question, sir?
No, you cannot.
The Supreme Court has ruled that the checkpoints are constitutional, and the Border Patrol says it can't allow people to keep agents from doing their jobs or interrupt trade and travel. But according to the Fifth Amendment, you can refuse to state your citizenship at a checkpoint.
I am not answering any questions, no.
I didn't hear you, I'm sorry.
I'm not answering any questions, no.
None at all?
Not without an attorney present.
The challengers span the political spectrum. Some sound like they've got left-wing views. Others, probably most, are right-leaning libertarians. They won't state their citizenship, but it's easy to tell they're Americans by their self-confidence about their civil rights.
I mean, you can keep asking me over and over again, but, you know, I don't have to answer questions. I mean, this isn't Nazi Germany, right?
The protesters tend to be white. Very few have Latino names or looks or accents. That might seem odd. After all, the Southwest is heavy with checkpoints, and the population is heavy with Latinos. People there have complained bitterly about mistreatment by Border Patrol agents. They're often accused of not distinguishing undocumented immigrants and criminals from everyday law-abiding Mexican Americans. Even so, the Latinos on YouTube seem less cheeky and more fearful than the white challengers. Take this recording of a young Latino on a bus at a checkpoint in South Texas.
Because you're not telling us where you were born.
Do I have to tell you where I was born?
Yes. Oh, you have to.
Why is that?
Since the man won't state his citizenship, he's just been ordered off the bus. He's a huge guy, maybe 300 pounds, someone who could throw his weight around, not at the checkpoint. Talking to border agents, he clutches a pocket-sized copy of the Bill of Rights adorned with red, white, and blue stripes. He's trembling.
Well, I don't need to be answering to your question. You know that. Why would I need to prove that here in the sweet state of America?
Eventually, the man is allowed back on the bus. He inches into his seat, trying to catch his breath. His fear is no surprise.
In a place like Laredo, a checkpoint is as ordinary as checking the mail. It's no big deal. It's part of life.
Guillermo Jimenez should know. He grew up in Laredo, Texas, right on the Mexico line. Border agents abound in Laredo.
They're very much looked upon as these pillars of society.
Guillermo calls himself a libertarian. 2 years ago, he and a Latino friend challenged a checkpoint near Laredo.
Sir, are you a citizen?
I don't have to answer that question, sir.
What's that?
I don't have to answer that question. I'm sorry.
What country are you a citizen of?
Again, I'm sorry. I don't have to answer that question, sir. We just want to go on our way.
I don't want to hold up traffic. I want to freely travel down the road. May I do that?
The agent let Guillermo and his friend go. They were luckier than Omar Figueredo and Nancy Morales.
It was fine. Yeah. I was like, what did I do? Yeah.
Omar and Nancy are graduate students at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Both are dark-skinned, dark-eyed, and dark-haired. She's from South Central Los Angeles, the daughter of immigrants from Oaxaca. He was born just across the border in Matamoros and raised in South Texas. His mother is a U.S. citizen, but she mistakenly thought that Guillermo wasn't. She told him to say he was a citizen when they went through checkpoints.
So I knew that there was something different, right? That I couldn't just be myself.
About 10 years ago, Omar confirmed that he actually was a citizen. Last year, he took Nancy to South Texas to meet his family. They'd been impressed by the checkpoint videos on YouTube, even though they'd noticed that glaring fact about the challengers.
I was like, well, of course, this is easy for them, right? Because they're clearly not, you know, a person of color.
When it came time to leave Texas, Omar and Nancy decided to do their own challenge at a checkpoint at the airport in Brownsville. Omar's mother urged them not to.
She was very scared. We talked about all these feelings that I had been kind of harboring or keeping bottled up, about how it felt to grow up feeling different and not knowing like what it meant. I cried, you know, and my mom.
Omar and Nancy went ahead with their challenge.
Hi.
Are you a U.S. citizen?
I refuse to answer that question.
You're not going through here.
Let me go through if I'm not under arrest. If I'm not being detained, I have not committed any kind of crime.
The border agents called local police, who arrested Omar, then Nancy, when she protested.
What is the crime? What is the crime? What is the crime? What is the crime? What is the crime?
Omar was put on trial in Brownsville earlier this year for the misdemeanor of blocking a passageway at the airport. His trial ended in a hung jury. He's set for retrial later this month. Nancy is charged with interfering with Omar's arrest and blocking the passageway. She's also headed for court. If they're convicted, they both face possible fines and jail time. Even so, they say they're comfortable with what they did. They just wanted to go home without fearing checkpoints at the border and with their identities intact as Americans and Latinos. For Latino USA, this is Debbie Nathan.
The United States deports nearly 400,000 individuals every year, and each one of those deportees has a story. Today, the story of Marco Merino. He grew up in Florida. His parents brought him to the United States from Chile when he was only 5 months old. In 2007, he was sent back. Eilish O'Neill visited him in Santiago, Chile.
My name is Marco Merino. I'm 37 years old. I grew up in Miami, Florida.
When Marco Merino was 18 years old, his father died. To honor his memory, Marco decided to keep his Chilean citizenship and not apply for a U.S. passport.
To me, immigration was just something that immigrants dealt with. You know, I didn't consider myself an immigrant.
In 2006, Marco left the U.S. for the first time since he arrived in the country as an infant. When he tried to return to Miami, he was stopped by an immigration official because of a 12-year-old drug charge. As an 18-year-old, Merino got two misdemeanor convictions for possessing a tab of LSD and half a joint. So when he tried to come back to the U.S., his permanent residency was revoked and he was forced to appear in immigration court. There, because of his two drug charges, the judge found him guilty of an aggravated felony, a deportable offense. After 6 months in a detention center, Merino says he'd had enough. He signed his deportation papers and was sent to Chile. As he left the airplane, he was directed to the line for Chileans.
Now I'm arriving in the citizens' line, which was awkward to me because I was in a foreign place. I go to the front, and as I get there, you know, I see the officers, and it kind of scared me. You know, it intimidated me. The last time I had been through something like that wasn't very nice. So the guy looks at my paper, and it's basically empty. So he's like, looks at me, where's your address? Sir, I don't know. Where are you going? I don't know. I don't know, you know, and everything, that was the answer to everything, you know? I don't know. I don't know. I guess he got frustrated with my answers, I assume, and he just turned towards his computer, starts, you know, going off on the keyboard, and all of a sudden he looks at the screen and his face changed, and he says, wait a minute. You left here in 1977. I said, yeah. And he goes, and this is your first time back? And I said, yeah, right? And he goes, oh, okay. Esta tu patria. Bienvenido. I'll never, ever forget those words, you know, like, this is your country. Welcome.
When Marco Merino walked out, his aunt was waiting. She took him in and helped him get on his feet. He worked a couple of jobs, one as a sound engineer and one as a tour guide, till he settled into his current work as an English teacher. He now rents a house in Santiago suburbs where he lives with his two dogs, which he flew over from the States.
I find myself mingling and creating meaningful relationships more with people that can actually speak English because I can't ever really express myself too well in Spanish. I do find the Chilean men are extremely macho, afraid of a woman who can talk. That's been really hard to understand. And the weather has been horrible for me growing up in Miami, so close to the equator. I have never bought a scarf. I had never had to buy boots, waterproof boots. I didn't know there was waterproof boots.
Merino's siblings and nieces and nephews have visited him in Chile. But he says he's now resigned to the fact he'll never again set foot in the U.S.
I would probably say I've left behind a lot of my past memories, a big part of my heart, you know, and I definitely feel at times like I'm not home, you know. But that doesn't mean I don't enjoy where I am, and it doesn't mean that I dislike where I am. No, I love it, and it's got a whole different meaning, and it keeps growing every day.
Marco Merino lives in Santiago, Chile. For Latino USA, I'm Alicia O'Neill.
Coming up on Latino USA...
Gracias, Santísima Muerte. Gracias, Todos Santos y Espíritus aquí. Thank you very much, everyone who has gathered here for this chaplet.
The Mexican folk saint whose popularity is growing among white people. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Trasnocharé hasta el día de mi muerte. Me entregaré como una hiedra la muda caricia de una pared. Seré el agua que alivia tu sed. Si me quieres, déjame partir. Si no, vete ya mismo de aquí. Que ya yo veo lo que tengo que hacer. Lo haré con toda la fuerza de mi ser hasta el día de mi muerte.
Trabajaré pa' mi familia y lucharé para un más bello amanecer. Con orgullo de mi patria y mi mujer.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Ferguson has brought it to the forefront, but it's not a new problem. Each and every year, unarmed individuals across the country die in police shootings. Several studies show that the highest numbers of victims are Black, followed by Latinos, and that the majority of police officers involved are white. Often, the victims are forgotten in the public eye, but that's not the case in San Francisco. Reporter Miriam Jamil brings us the story of Alejandro Nieto, whose supporters refuse to let his case close without accountability.
On the 21st of every month, a crowd gathers on San Francisco's Bernal Hill, a windy spot near the Mission District that overlooks the rest of the city. They come here to remember. 28-year-old Alejandro Nieto died here in March, reportedly as he stood eating his dinner.
We ask forgiveness for these police. I ask that they have a change of heart, that they realize that they have committed a terrible cruelty, that just because we are people of color doesn't mean that our life isn't worth much. It is worth a lot.
Alex Nieto was shot at least 10 times by San Francisco police officers who say they thought he was carrying a gun. It turned out he wasn't. He had a taser on his hip, which he used in his job as a security guard at a nightclub. The San Francisco Police Department won't comment on Alex's case because it's in litigation, and details about his death are murky. One thing his supporters say with certainty is that his death adds to a growing list of unarmed people of color who have died at the hands of law enforcement.
We're here to remember a young man. But we're here also to remember all the young men who are being victims of violence by the police in this country and around the world.
About 40 people stand to pray, along with Alex's family. Friends come forward to speak, to recite poetry, to sing.
Cuando podamos bajar nuestras manos.
When will we be able to put our hands down, the singer asks, to sleep with our eyes closed? Alex's parents, Refugio and Elvira Nieto, came to San Francisco from Guanajuato, Mexico in 1984. Their son died around 7 p.m. on Friday, March 21st, but they didn't find out until the next afternoon.
Nos sentamos. El oficial que iba a encargar, porque eran tres, dice, este es el lugar de Alejandro, aquí donde dormía, sí. Y dice, ¿quién era Alejandro? Pues nuestro hijo.
We sat down, and the officer in charge says, is this where Alex is to sleep? Yes. He asks, who was Alejandro? He was our son. Are you sure? Yes. And the officer asks, what did Alejandro used to do? Did he work? Yes. And then he asked, what type of drugs did he do? Marijuana? Cocaine? And that seemed strange to me. I said, did you come here to give us information about Alejandro, or did you come to interrogate us? He stopped his questions and explained, they killed your son yesterday, the 21st of March, 7 in the evening. He said they killed him.
And that's essentially where the details end. The names of the officers involved haven't been released, nor have the police or autopsy reports. Alex's parents don't really know why their son is dead, and the police did little to enlighten them.
Me tocó el dolor de él, y este dolor es el más grande que estoy pasando. Al no saber nada de lo que sucedió, ni cómo hacerlo, ni nada.
The biggest pain that I'm experiencing is not knowing anything about what happened or what I can do.
What I've learned from mothers and family who have lost their children is that this type of loss is almost like a reconstruction of their DNA.
Attorney Adriana Camarena is part of the Justice y Amor for Alex Nieto Committee. They're a group of Alex's friends in the Mission District who have been organizing on his behalf since he passed.
I started realizing that we were already kind of thrust into trauma. I think in the cumulative experience of seeing how young people are treated in the mission and the hardships that families go through just because they're poor or their ethnicity is Latino or African American or in other ways considered a minority.
The Mission District has long been home to a concentration of Mexican and Central American immigrants. But lately, the population has been changing, thanks partly to San Francisco's booming tech industry. Alex was well known in the local Latino community, but not to others in the area, like the person who reportedly called 911 about a Latin male with a gun on his hip.
Hey, there's a guy in a red shirt way up the hill, walking toward you guys.
I got a guy right here.
The police department's radio dispatch shows that Alex was shot within about 25 seconds of their encounter.
Shots fired, 233 shots fired.
Maria Vialta, another member of the Justice y Amor Committee, has seen a lot of violence in the neighborhood over the years. But she says it's Alex's death that has affected her the most.
Just growing up in the Mission, you have this... You are kind of not raised to hate the police, because it's not hate. It's just you're raised to know that they're not on your side. To me, they're the biggest gang in the city right now.
The police department declined to comment for this story because Alex's case is currently in court. It also didn't respond to requests for comment about its relationship with the community. But just a few days after the shooting, the police chief addressed more than 300 people at a town hall meeting. He said that Alex drew his taser when the officers asked him to put his hands up, and the officers believed it was a gun.
Because of the situation, the call, the appearance that he had a firearm, they fired in defense of their own lives. And Mr. Nieto did not survive.
Photos of Alex's body obtained by his attorneys show that he was shot at least 10 times. The police chief said his officers continued shooting because Alex's weapon was still drawn, even after he fell to the ground. But many people from his community don't buy this version of events. At a local march, over 100 protesters walked from the spot where Alex was killed down to San Francisco's federal courthouse about 3 miles away. A circle of Aztec dancers leads the way, their tall headpiece feathers rising above the crowd.
We're good people. We love, we hurt, we bleed. We're here today because we say this is an injustice and it isn't right. What do we want?
Justice!
How do we want it?
Now!
That's 17-year-old Violeta Vasquez.
I'm here to fight for somebody who was educated and was doing something good for the community. And at the end of the day, they still got shot because of the color of their skin. And so I don't.
Alex was educated. He was studying administration of justice and had even interned with the city's probation department. He was also a practicing Buddhist. Many people who knew him say they couldn't wrap their minds around the idea of him being violent. And they feel that regardless, they shouldn't have to use these details to argue that he shouldn't have been murdered. The Nietos have filed a federal wrongful death lawsuit against the city, the police chief, and the officers involved in the shooting. The Nietos' attorneys are seeking monetary damages. But Alex's father, Refugio, says that what they really want is clarity on what actually happened and for the police to be held accountable.
Está un proceso muy, muy largo. Poco que me han explicado por ahí dicen que esto va a tardar a lo mejor 2 años.
This is going to be a really, really long process. They've explained me that it'll take at best 2 years. We have to wait, we have to keep fighting with the police, and for me, that's what makes it hard to keep it together.
Alex's supporters say they're determined to follow the case through. Refugio says he prays to God to give him patience. For Latino USA, I'm Mariam Jamil in San Francisco.
Well, my dear listeners, there is one good thing about getting older. I'm hardly afraid of anything anymore. But death, well, cualquiera se espanta. But there are popular Mexican traditions that not only embrace death, they worship it and ask it for favors. We're talking about La Santa Muerte, or Holy Death, the skeleton-like folk saint that originated in Mexico and is the fusion of the Grim Reaper along with indigenous deities of death from Mexico. La Santa Muerte got a lot more popular when she was featured on the TV show Breaking Bad. In one episode, the narco hitmen trying to kill Walter White leave a sketch of Walter on her altar. Now, just to be clear, narcos make up only a small contingent of La Santa Muerte's following. Religious studies professor Andrew Chestnut of Virginia Commonwealth University wrote the first book about La Santa Muerte in the U.S. and Mexico.
Santa Muerte's growth has been nothing short of explosive since 2001. We don't have any hard data, but between the U.S., Mexico, and Central America, we're probably looking at some 10 to 12 million devotees.
Up to now, the worship of La Santa Muerte has grown in the U.S. mostly among Mexican and Central American immigrants. But according to Professor Chestnut, that's changing.
One of the fascinating new trends in the last 2 years is her growth among Euro-Americans and African-Americans as well.
We found a chapel for La Santa Muerte in New Orleans, where all the congregants are white. We joined them for an evening of prayer. Stephen Bragg, the owner of the chapel, explains what drew him to the Mexican death saint.
My name is Stephen Bragg. I work a day job. I'm a senior passport specialist at the New Orleans Passport Agency. And then when I get out of work, I come home and I do my spiritual work.
Santísima Muerte la Blanca, Santísima Muerte la Negra. Gracias, muchas gracias. Thank you, Santísima Muerte, for all the things that you have done for us. We gather here.
I am 38 years old. I was born and raised in Mississippi. I graduated Mississippi State University with a bachelor's degree in philosophy and world religious studies. I was raised generally early on in life Christian. I began attending a Pentecostal church, the Church of God, where I attended from about age 10 to about 16. I guess I could say once I came into puberty, I realized I was not attracted to women, I was attracted to men, and so that's probably the pivotal point in my life where I started turning away from Christianity and looking into other faiths. I've journeyed through the world of Haitian voodoo, Western mystical systems. I have received initiations into a Cuban religion called Palo Mayombe, and coming to La Santísima Muerte, this is a very familiar territory for me. Even though I am white American, I grew up very poor myself in the countryside of Mississippi, and I have this sympathy for those who are also growing up in poor areas. And it really doesn't matter what culture or country you come from, when you grow up poor, you grow up poor. And there's just some things that, you share with other people who have grown up poor. Santísima Muerte loves people, especially who are sort of out of the norm. She became very popular because she spread very rapidly through what people would call the fringe of society, those who the Catholic Church have turned away. I have an entire room here in my home, this lovely New Orleans shotgun house where all the rooms line up one after the other. And in the room, I have three large altars. And they take up pretty much an entire wall with Nick's altar on one side and then another table with a lamp on the other.
Right, yeah, and also we are free to hit off the tequila as long as it's enough for offerings to Michael and...
A lot of ice.
So the people who are coming tonight and the people who usually come to the chaplain services are typically of American, white, Caucasian, whatever you want to call that. The majority of the Latinos that visit are the ones that visit the outdoor shrine. And they come, they pray at the altars outside, they leave the candles and their offerings out there. We start the chaplet service by gathering in the room, lighting the candles, lighting the incense, and making sure that all of the waters on the altar are refreshed, making sure that all of the drinks are there, flowers are in place, all of the offerings that we want to give her are there.
In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come.
Then we sit down and we begin our prayers. We begin with one Our Father, three Hail Marys, a Glory Be, a prayer to St. Michael, and then the invocational prayer to Santísima Muerte.
In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we ask for permission to invoke the Santísima Muerte, Holy and Powerful Mother. At this moment, we beg for your presence.
Then everyone is able to move about the room and go to any of the altars that they wish to go to and, ask for a favor, ask for a miracle, if they have a petition that they've written up.
Amen. Anyone who wishes to
come before the altar.
A folk saint is just a saint that is not officially recognized by the Catholic Church. It can be an ancestor spirit. If that ancestor spirit is fulfilling prayers, then that's a saint. And where a lot of other saints do not answer the prayers of those people, Santissima Muerte has come in and she's fulfilled that job. And the reason for this is because she is what they call milagrosa. She's a miracle worker. I was living in New Orleans when Katrina hit in 2005, and I relocated to the Boston area of Massachusetts. It was there that I met a man named Nick Arnoldi. Nicholas lived in Mexico. He went there for a juvenile rehab program, and he just happened to meet a man called an hechicero, or a sorcerer. And it was from that person that Nick learned about Santa Muerte and how to work with her and how to pray to her and devote himself to her. And apparently she came to him and said that she needed him to teach me everything that he had learned in Mexico. Nicholas was on a lot of different medications for issues he had. He ran out of one of his prescriptions, and from what I'm told, it sent his brain into a very dark place. And one night in August of that year, he took his own life. He passed away in 2012, so I keep an altar for him over here in this corner. And his favorite beer was Blue Moon, so I've got some Blue Moon there. He loved vodka, got a bottle there. And it has his picture, and it's one of my favorite because he was very handsome. And it's just him, you know, in a blue shirt with a tie on and looking very Nick-ish. Have her come into my life through Nick, that does show that she does care greatly about our happiness. And for a very short time, I was as happy as I had ever been in my life. And even though it was followed by tragedy, I still remember that feeling of being extremely happy. And for that, you know, I always thank Santissima Muerte. That was a miracle that she did before I even really knew who she was.
In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Gracias, Santissima Muerte. Gracias, todos santos y espíritus aquí. Thank you very much, everyone who has gathered here for this chaplet. We bid you good night.
La Santa Muerte's following among non-Latinos is very small, but her popularity keeps growing thanks to Facebook and other social networks, and she's especially popular for being good with love requests. To find out more about the worship of La Santa Muerte in the U.S., visit our website, latinousa.org. Coming up on Latino USA.
As long as we remember those who came before us and those who are no longer with us, they're here. They're here with us.
A new movie that celebrates the Day of the Dead. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Con el atardecer me iré de aquí. Me iré sin ti. Me alejaré de ti con un dolor dentro de mí. Ay, qué calor que hace en el balcón de Paul. Ay, qué calor que hace cuando se va el sol. Situación, pero todos terminan en el balcón. Se preguntan por qué de día está cerrado y cuando despunta la noche se pone alborotado, pero nunca nadie ha contado qué pasó, porque ninguno que entra sale igual que como entró. Son puras conjeturas lo que ocurre allá adentro, uno mismo
se figura que es de un sismo el epicentro. No hay censura, subalternos, compromiso ni gobierno. Es en la altura un pasadizo al paraíso en el infierno. Y ahí se actúa con desparpajo. Nada se ve ni de una grúa, ni de arriba, ni de abajo. Y sin trabajo ni overol, obtenés lo que ves. Todos hablan de Polinario.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm María Hinojosa. You may have heard us talk about the year 2043. That's the year that the U.S. Census projects that whites will no longer be the numerical majority in this country. But just because this country is headed toward a more diverse future doesn't mean that there aren't still places resisting that change and remaining overwhelmingly white, places that author Rich Benjamin calls whitetopias.
A whitetopia is a county that is extremely white.
That's Rich. He's the author of Searching for Whitetopia,
an improbable journey to the heart of white America.
He also says whitetopias are places that grew significantly between 2000 and 2006.
And the third element of whitetopia is it has a je ne sais quoi, an ineffable look and charm to it that attracts white migrants.
So your land goes that way?
It does.
Quite
it goes,
a bit?
It goes out to the middle of the road. We're on 10 acres.
10 acres.
Yes.
In Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, near the Canadian border, I met up with the Boland family, Pat and Kim and their two children, Kelly and Jimmy. Like many families in Coeur d'Alene, the Bolands are transplants. They moved in 2001 from Los Angeles, where both of them worked in law enforcement, to the smaller, quieter life of the Idaho Panhandle.
I was scheduled for promotion, so I was excited. And the next day, the promotion list came out, and I wasn't on it. And it was removed because the list wasn't ethnically pure enough. And that really bothered me.
So, did you feel that you were being discriminated because of the fact that you were a white man?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, based on those stories, wouldn't you feel that way?
Of the town's 46,000 residents, 92% of them are white, compared to 63% of the United States in general. In his own travels to Coeur d'Alene, Rich Benjamin talked to many residents who, like the Bolands, had come from L.A.
They're leaving communities where they felt social strife or where they felt sort of alienated because they heard so much Spanish, and therefore I came to Coeur d'Alene.
But of course, even whitetopias are not completely immune to diversity.
Coeur d'Alene reminds me of my little town in Mexico.
That's Patricia Gonzalez. She's a manager at Altilano's Mexican restaurant in Coeur d'Alene.
You get to know everybody, you know everybody, you know what everybody do.
But the town has not always been the most welcoming place for immigrants, non-whites, and even non-Christians.
The Zebulun up here is a symbol of the Aryan nations. That is your race.
In 1974, Richard Grint Butler moved from California to northern Idaho, near Coeur d'Alene, to start the Aryan Nations. This white supremacist organization was focused on creating a white haven in the Pacific Northwest. While never a powerful entity, the Aryan Nations did persist well into the 2000s. And 2 years ago, Patricia had her own run-in with some of Coeur d'Alene's white supremacists.
My brother came to me and said, "Hey, you know there is a KKK." I was like, "Yes, why?" Like, they coming over.
Patricia told me that at 11 a.m. that day, a group of about 8 men and women in their 30s and 40s, wearing black jeans and black T-shirts, lined up on the restaurant sidewalk holding signs.
What did the sign say?
"Keep America white." I was like, "What did I do wrong?"
But then something incredible happened.
Customers start coming. In less than 15 minutes, I have this place full of customers.
Despite Patricia's positive experience with the community, there is still something unique happening in places like Coeur d'Alene. The idea of whitetopia is still real, and it's still rooted in whiteness. And that, says Rich Benjamin, has unsettling implications.
I don't feel that these are innocuous, harmless pockets of Americana that we could just look at, you know, and be academically curious. Whitetopias do have an impact, even on those who don't live in them, because in many cases, the representatives of these community exercise political power way out of proportion than their actual constituents' numbers.
And be sure to check out this week's episode of our new television series, America by the Numbers, to find out how you can watch the episode, Our Private Idaho, on the World Channel and on PBS. Check your local listings or visit americabythenumbers.org. Growing up, young and brown or black in this country can be a scary thing. And it's been highlighted time and time again by stories about police interactions with people of color. But even when nobody ends up shot or injured, going to jail can be a terrifying, life-changing experience. Take the case of Kalief Browder, who was profiled recently in the New Yorker magazine. He spent over 1,000 days in jail on Rikers Island, here in New York, without a trial, and spent much of that time in solitary. Jennifer Gonerman, the reporter of the story, joins us now from Brooklyn. Welcome to Latino USA, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit, Jennifer, about how you came upon this story.
The more I looked into it, the more important I thought his story was, because even though his case is a pretty extreme example of what can go wrong in the system, his case also illustrates so many of the institutional failings of our entire criminal justice system. Everything from the state of indigent defense, which is the sort of legal representation that poor people get from court-appointed attorneys, to the right to a speedy trial, which barely even exists in the Bronx, to jail conditions, the overuse of solitary confinement. And another issue, which is I would call it post-traumatic stress disorder, but the impact of spending so much time in solitary on a young person in particular.
In your piece, you actually quote someone that's saying that if a parent locked their 16-year-old as, you know, as punishment and locked them in their room for 23 hours, you know, a day, that you would be arrested for endangering the welfare of a child. And yet, this is our city doing the same thing to our kids.
I know, that's one of the most disturbing quotes in the entire piece.
Well, how do we square that? I mean, especially because Rikers did have a reformer as the commissioner before the current commissioner, who was saying that they were trying to humanize Rikers.
But on Rikers Island, they have something which they call cell study, which is an officer coming to your door in the morning and dropping off a couple of worksheets and telling the teenager that he's going to come back and pick them up in 2 days, 3 days, 4 days. And so Kalief would actually really work on these worksheets, math, you know, reading, writing, because he figured, well, I'm already locked up. You know, I got to do something. I might as well just try to do something to pass the time. And then the day would come when the worksheet would be due, or he thought the worksheet would be due. And sometimes they would come to pick it up, but sometimes they wouldn't come to pick it up. And he would find himself sort of at the window, banging on the door of his solitary cell, saying, "Where is the correction officer to pick up my work?" Now, you know, it is kind of just a minor detail in a much longer story, but it really, really stuck with me because I felt like it really spoke volumes about, you know, the complete apathy and lack of any regard for his basic human rights, you know, the right to get an education.
In terms of this reporting with Kalief and the lost 3 years, almost 4 years of his life, what do you think that you can draw on in terms of how young men of color are treated when it comes to due process and constitutional rights?
You know, you only have to take one trip to Rikers Island or just about any, you know, jail or prison and around here and walk through the visiting room and see who is, you know, most significantly impacted by all of our criminal justice policies. You know, whether it's who gets arrested, who gets bail, who can make bail, who gets a right to a speedy trial, who doesn't, and who ends up, you know, enduring the punishment of Rikers Island.
Jennifer, what do you think? I mean, Kalief is out now. What is he fearful of now?
You know, he told me when I interviewed him shortly before this story came out that every night before he goes to sleep, he checks to make sure that every window in the house is locked. Or when he rides the subway, he always feels terrified. And he told me, "I might be attacked, I might be robbed, because believe me, in jail, you know, there's all type of criminal stuff that goes on." You know, I think he cannot, of course, forget all of the things that he witnessed. And all of those things that he either saw happened or which happened to himself, are enough to keep somebody fearful for a very long time.
The piece is called Before the Law, A Boy Was Accused of Taking a Backpack, the courts took the next 3 years of his life. It came out in the October 6th issue of The New Yorker. Jennifer Gonerman, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA and for all of your work.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
There have been so many Halloween-themed children's movies. It's really over the top, right? But finally, mis queridos, El Día de los Muertos, The Day of the Dead, is getting its moment in Hollywood.
Where am I?
Welcome to the land of the remember.
The Book of Life, produced by Guillermo del Toro, comes out later this month. Jorge Gutierrez, the director of the movie, and his wife, Sandra Equiwa, a character designer for the film, spoke to us about why El Día de los Muertos, or the Day of the Dead, was so important to them that they wanted to make a film about it.
Day of the Dead, the nugget of what the holiday is. As long as we remember those who came before us and those who are no longer with us, as long as we sing their songs, cook their favorite dishes, we tell their jokes, they're here. They're here with us. The moment we don't talk about them, then they really are gone.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the core of Day of the Dead. But it's also the other thing I love about it is it's sort of a checks and balances for a family or for a generation to say, look at what those before you did and look at what we remember them for. What are you going to do so that we remember you?
I love you too much to leave without you loving me back. I love you too much.
Sandra and I have been together since high school. We met in Tijuana at a concert, and I kind of fell in love with her. And so when I proposed to her, 2 weeks after we met, she said no. And so I realized, well, this is going to be harder than I thought. So we dated for a long time. And then on Day of the Dead, with my friend next to me, I proposed to her again. And she said yes. So then after that, I said, well, let's get married on Day of the Dead. And we went around Tijuana to every priest, and they all said no. And so we had to go and we found this priest who was kind enough to say, okay, let's hear why you want to get married on that day. And I said, the biggest reason is I want to make sure all our families are there, like from every generation, to see this new union. And he said, that's exactly what Day of the Dead is, so I will do it for you. And then after that, we got married on Day of the Dead. It was a crazy Day of the Dead wedding.
For the majority of the Latino community, we are very, very conscious of what the celebration is. For other cultures, you know, it might not be as clear. There are a lot of people that know about it, but some might not. So therefore, by putting our movie so close to the celebration of Halloween, you know, it's kind of gonna grab their attention, leading them to think, oh, maybe Halloween movie. But when they look at it, they're gonna be like, oh my gosh, it's a completely different celebration and it's so beautiful and it has nothing to do with Halloween. So it's an introduction to a new celebration. And we got it, you know, the chiripazo, as they say, by mistake. Maybe it was a happy coincidence.
I would like to say that I wish every studio made a Day of the Dead movie.
How PC.
That was Jorge Gutierrez, the director of the new animated film, The Book of Life, and Sandra Equiwa, his wife and a character designer for the movie. The movie comes out October 17th. To learn more about The Book of Life, visit our website, latinousa.org. To end our show now, some words of wisdom or sabiduría. It's a medical diagnosis none of us wants to ever have to hear. You have cancer. Maria Emilia Martin is Latino USA's founding executive producer. She got that diagnosis. As unwelcome as it is, she says that cancer can have its silver lining.
It was several weeks after I've received the diagnosis of breast cancer. All plans went out the window as I entered that place called Cancerland. I'd been visiting my 99-year-old father when cancer first reared its ugly head. Through my tears and my fears, I said to my father, "You know how they say every cloud has a silver lining, Dad? One gift of this cancer is that I've gotten to spend more time with you. I won't pretend that entering Cancerland was not about the most frightening thing I've ever had to face. At first, it feels as if you're dropping down a black hole. But in the 4 months since the diagnosis, stage four, by the way, Cancerland is no longer so scary. Cancer is in my body, but I'm fighting it. It isn't me. And some of the changes it's brought haven't been entirely negative. I've stayed in the U.S. rather than return to Guatemala. It's as if my body is telling me to go to a place that's more healing, easier to live in than Guatemala, with its high rate of crime, drugs, and corruption so many are trying to flee. Another blessing of the cancer has been a huge outpouring of love and support. Perhaps the greatest gift I've discovered is learning my life has meant something to a not small number of people. As a single woman living out of the country, I've sometimes felt socially disconnected. But since my diagnosis, I've felt so much support and generosity from friends and family, and even from people I don't even know very well or at all, especially from women who've survived cancer and whose advice and support have been like a warm blanket on a cold and lonely evening. Above all, I've received tremendous support from my radio community, though it's been more than 10 years since I left Latino USA to work and train journalists in Latin America. Before this happened, I would say to myself that I never wanted to fall into that category of people who are remembered and recognized for their contributions only after they die. But I've received some of that recognition now. Every phone call, get well card, even monetary contribution has sent me a message that I'm not alone on this cancer journey. And I, like millions of Latinas and other women with this disease, have decided that with advances in modern medicine, better nutrition, spiritual practice, and support from family and friends, we are not dying of cancer, but living with it. Maybe even living a little bit better. There's nothing like looking death in the face to appreciate every single day and to say, gracias a la vida.
Y muchísimas gracias por tu sabiduría, María Emilia Martin. We are so thankful for all you have done, and we are thinking of you and sending you love and light. María Emilia Martin is the founding executive producer of Latino USA. And that's it for today, mis queridos listeners. Well, at least on the radio. Our new TV show on PBS and the World Channel, America by the Numbers with Maria Hinojosa, is taking on this issue of white anxiety along with demographic change. Check out americabythenumbers.org for more information and look for us on PBS and online at the World Channel. And most important, let us know what you think of America by the Numbers with Maria Hinojosa and spread the word. And muchas gracias. Latino USA is produced by A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Laura Calzada and Julia Hsu. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram. And I'll see you on public television.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Funding for Latino USA comes from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security at carnegie.org.
Thank you. I had to pick it up here, the invisible espresso.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring with a Floor Finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. And Patricia Papper, supporting Perez Art Museum Miami, providing progressive art programming to Miami-Dade County residents and visitors. This is NPR.